WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Writers Week on Fresh Air, and today we're going into the archive to listen back to writers who are no longer with us. In the last two decades of this century, we lost many great artists to the AIDS epidemic. After chronicling what it's like to lose friends and lovers to AIDS, writer Paul Monnett died of complications from AIDS in 1995. He won a National Book Award in 1992 for his memoir, Becoming a Man. It focused on life before the AIDS epidemic, when he was coming of age and was afraid to come out of the closet. He became nationally known after the publication of his 1988 memoir, Borrowed Time, which described how he nursed his lover of 12 years, Roger Horowitz, while Horowitz was dying of AIDS. Monnett later lost a second lover to the epidemic. In 1988, on Fresh Air, he read from the opening of Borrowed Time.
I don't know if I will live to finish this. Doubtless there's a streak of self-importance in such an assertion, but who's counting? Maybe it's just that I've watched too many sicken in a month and die by Christmas, so that a fatal sort of realism comforts me more than magic. All I know is this. The virus ticks in me. And it doesn't care a whit about our categories. When is full-blown? What's AIDS-related? What is just sick and tired? No one has solved the puzzle of its timing. I take my drug from Tijuana twice a day. The very friends who tell me how vigorous I look, how well I seem, are the first to assure me of the imminent medical breakthrough. What they don't seem to understand is I used up all my optimism keeping my friend alive. Now that he's gone, the cup of my own health is neither half full nor half empty, just half.
Paul Monnett returned to Fresh Air in 1992, less than a year after he'd been diagnosed with AIDS, just a month after three brain lesions were discovered. I asked him to think back to that passage that he'd read 4 years before about having used up his optimism trying to keep his lover alive.
They seem very prophetic to me now. What is poignant, Terry, is that I really did have I came back to a level of optimism, I think, a couple of years ago when I really believed, along with a lot of other AIDS activists, that we were on the brink of turning AIDS into a chronic, manageable illness. That was our phrase, and that was our hope. And it really seemed to be backed up by the excitement in the medical community. That has changed. There's a much more of a sense of darkness and despair and how hard the long term is going to be in the AIDS activism community now. I think ultimately we will turn this into that chronic manageable illness, but I will not live to see it.
You've taken care of two lovers who died of AIDS. Do you have a lover now to help take care of you?
I do. I've been very fortunate, and I've met a wonderful, strong man who buried a lover to AIDS about, nearly a year ago now, 8 or 9 months ago. His name is Winston, and, we understand that we're loving in the midst of war and that the bombs could go off at any moment. It's a very difficult position to be in, though. It was difficult enough to care for somebody and to watch them die and to be unsure about when that's going to happen. It's heartbreaking to be in the position of being sick and to watch someone else worry.
Are there times when you look at your lover and see yourself because you've been through this?
Oh, so much. I so much see the a kind of quality of positive denial, whereby he is able to or insists on maintaining a positive attitude about it and me, and that reminds me very much of how I got through with Roger during those 20 months. I felt in a way that one mistake I had made in treating Roger and in caring for him was that I really hadn't talked much with him about death. And I remember my therapist said to me after Roger died, and I was feeling guilty about that, well, you know, guess what? You would have had a conversation and you would have both decided that death sucked, and that would have been that. I mean, I think that's probably true. I don't know what to say about death, and here I am facing it.
When your lover Roger died in 86, I don't did you feel like that was it at all? Do you know ever that like you wouldn't be able to have another lover again because the loss was so great, or did you feel different than that? Like life is short, and you were going to keep your heart open to other people.
I went from the first feeling to the second feeling over a period of about a year and a half. In the months after Roger died, I was crazy. I just was an insane person. I mean, the grief hit me like insanity. I remember thinking that the only reason to get up in the morning was that the dog had to be fed. I mean, I was that close to a kind of inside suicide. And I also had a record to leave. I mean, whatever writerly passion or ego had survived Roger's death consumed me during the next year as I wrote about him, and that definitely got me through. And I assumed that I would be diagnosed with some horror at any time. But by the time I met Stephen in the summer of 88, I really did feel, just as you said, I might as well take a chance. What else is there? I've come to believe that, I mean, one of the things I say a lot is that I would rather be remembered for loving well than mm-hmm. writing well. I, as I said in Borrowed Time, I think that when people come to the end of their lives, as I've watched so many people do, what matters to them is how much they've loved. And, as they say out here, nobody ever wanted to read one more screenplay on his deathbed. I was open to it. Stephen was less open to it. I had to pursue him, I think. And he said to me when I met him, you know, I have 7 friends who are going to die in the next 6 months. And they did, one after another. And it took a great, great toll on him. And at the end of that 6 months, he was diagnosed himself with KS. But as I said to him, after we'd been together for about a year or a year and a half, it was quite clear to both of us that we were able to be happy despite all the rage and pain we felt, because loving one another was so what we had spent our lives trying to find.
You have a new memoir, and it's really your coming out story and the story of what your life was like when you had to cover up for who you were and you had to lie a lot before you came out. And you write in that book that every memoir now is a kind of manifesto. Before I ask you to read the opening of your new memoir, Becoming a Man, how sick were you when you were writing this? During how much of the time of writing this were you actually sick?
Fortunately, I was really not sick except for fevers during most of the year that I wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
I had wanted to write it because so many people had said to me about my relationship with Roger that it seemed like the perfect relationship, and they romanticized it a good deal, and as well they might. It was an incredible relationship. But I would often think, God, if anybody really understood the loser and the lost that I was during the 25 years before I met Roger, I probably need to tell them that I was the most, to me anyway, the most unlikely person to find a great love. And that's what spurred me on. What I didn't expect was how difficult it would be to actually confront the past honestly. During the first 50 pages of it, I would think, oh, everyone should do this. This is very exciting. And by the time I reached page 100, I thought, nobody should do this. This is too depressing.
Paul, let me ask you to read the beginning of your new memoir, Becoming a Man.
Okay. It begins with a kind of manifesto, actually. Everybody else had a childhood, for one thing, where they were coaxed and coached and taught all the shorthand. Or that's how it always seemed to me, eavesdropping my way through 25 years, filling in the stories of straight men's lives. First they had their shining boyhood, which made them strong and psyched them up for the leap across the chasm to adolescence, where the real rights of manhood began. I grilled them about it whenever I could, slipping the casual question in while I did their Latin homework for them, sprawled on the lawn at Andover under the reeling elms. And every year they leaped further ahead, leaving me in the dust with all my doors closed, and each with a new and better deadbolt, Until I was 25, I was the only man I knew who had no story at all. I'd long since accepted the fact that nothing had ever happened to me, and nothing ever would. That's how the closet feels once you've made your nest in it and learned to call it home. Self-pity becomes your oxygen. 46 now, and dying by inches, I finally see how our lives align at the core, if not in the sorry details. I still shiver with a kind of astonished delight when a gay brother or sister tells of that narrow escape from the coffin world of the closet. Yes, 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 goes a voice in my head. It was just like that for me.
Paul Monette, recorded in 1992. He died of AIDS in 1995. Our Writers' Week series continues tomorrow on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air.